Hello everyone, I'm Sarah Ross, and welcome to Her Words, a podcast where we give voice to the stories of women's voices in the United Methodist Pulpit. Today, I will be speaking with Reverend Lynn Kilborn, who serves as the Director of Development at the Methodist Foundation for Arkansas. Hello everyone, I'm Sarah, and today I am joined by Reverend Lynn Kilborn, and she is going to share with us her stories of ministry in the United Methodist Church. So Lynn, could you start us off by just sharing a little bit about what you have done in your ministry up to this point?
I can start by saying that I'll start with my education history, I guess, and then get into my professional history. So I went to undergrad at Henderson State University in Arkadelphia, and I was a communication major. And then I went to, I pursued my MDiv at Duke Divinity School in North Carolina. And then I came back to Arkansas and started the ordination process in 2009. And I was ordained in 2011. So commissioned in 9, ordained in 11, and I've served three different churches. So my first appointment right out of seminary, I was the associate pastor at Bryant First United Methodist Church, and I was there for a couple of years. And in that position, I was the associate pastor, but I oversaw the youth ministry. So I was the youth minister, appointed associate pastor. And then from Bryant, I moved to Conway First United Methodist Church, where I was the associate pastor for 5 years. And that position was different because I oversaw all of the program ministries, and I got to preach every Sunday. And after 5 years at Conway, I was then appointed as the senior pastor of North Little Rock First United Methodist Church. And I was there for 5 years. And then in 2021, I made a big shift in my ministry, and I left the local church, and I now serve at the Methodist Foundation for Arkansas as the Director of Development. And I've been here now just over 3 years.
So you have lots of different types of experiences in ministry then.
I have. I guess I've been ordained 13 years, and I've been in ministry in Arkansas for 15 years, and I've kind of stayed around central Arkansas, but have had served churches of different sizes, they're kind of, a couple of them are similar sizes, now at the foundation.
Yeah, that's really cool. So as we get into your history of getting into your call of ministry, I want to start off with asking if you had experience with women pastors kind of in your formational years, maybe even before you got your calling, that made you realize that women can be in this ministerial role.
Yeah, I did not see a woman in ministry until I was in like high school. Mm-hmm. And I only saw her at like a youth, or actually a Walk to Emmaus event, that I was at a Chrysalis flight. And at Chrysalis flights, there are five clergy who are spiritual directors who are there serving as clergy. And one of them was a woman. And that was like the first time I had ever seen that. But I remember, as I look back on, like, I wasn't surprised, because somehow I knew women could do it. Somehow mm-hmm. I knew that we allowed women in ministry. And I actually think it had more to do with my mom and the way I was raised than who I saw in the church, because my mom was a civil engineer, which is she was in a male dominated field. And so from a very young age, my mom had always instilled in me this understanding that women can do anything. There's not a job that we can't do simply because we're women. So I saw my first minister, it was a woman, when I was in high school, but then by the time I was in college, I had a campus minister who was a female, and it never seemed like, I never remember thinking like, women aren't supposed to do this, or wow, I didn't know women could do this. I just always somehow understood women could be ministers because women can be civil engineers. Women can be anything.
Yeah. It's amazing to see how just your mom being in a field can help you understand that you can do anything too. So that's really beautiful. So now could you go into describing your call to ministry, and that process and how it took you from communications, I guess, all the way to seminary?
Yes. So communications was actually what I changed my major to when I entered my call into ministry, but I went to college to be a pharmacist because I wanted a job where I could make lots of money, but have lots of time off. And for some reason, I thought that was pharmacy. And I say I want lots of money, but really my mom, not only did she instill in me that women could be anything, but she also said, you always need to be able to take care of yourself and a family in case you ever have to, because the women in our family, my mom had to, she was a breadwinner of our family. And there was a season where my dad was unemployed for about 18 months. And so my mom was the sole supporter of our family. So I, and then in her mom, her dad passed away when she was a teenager. And so her mom was the sole provider of her family. So my mom said, you always need to be able to make enough to take care of yourself and a family in case you ever have to. So I was trying to find a job where I could make enough money to support myself and a family, but also have a ton of time that I could work at the church, volunteer at the church, and do the things that I was passionate about, because I felt this desire to be really involved at the church and lead things at the church. But I didn't think that I was called to lead a church. So I was trying to find another job that would give me the opportunity to be as involved in the church as I wanted it to be. And I kept thinking that I wasn't called into ministry because I didn't have like this burning bush moment that I didn't hear God say, Lynn, I want you to be a minister. But from the time that I was in junior high, I wanted to be in the pulpit. I would look up, I would see the pastor, you know, always a man. And I would think that looks like that. I don't know if I would say that looks like fun, but I would think like, I want to do that. I want to go stand and share about God in front of that group of people. I want to go and teach them, from up there. But I thought, man, pastors are so lucky that they got called to do that. I wish like God would call me. And in high school and then into college, you know, and I'm trying to be a pharmacist, I wrestled a lot because I was really mad at God that God didn't call me. And I would actually, I remember some prayers where I would say like, why didn't you want me, God? Like, why didn't you call me? And kind of making like a really long story short of lots of conversations with campus ministers, lots of conversations with pastors and leaders in local churches and in youth events that I was a chaperone for, lots of conversations of people encouraging me to pursue ministry and me saying, but God didn't call me. And I was like, I really want to, but God didn't call me. And eventually I realized that desire that I had upon my heart was God's call. But I literally sat in the pews of church and I thought, all of us who are sitting in the pews, all of us actually want to be up there. And then when someone said, no, like not all of us want to do that, I realized there was something different about me, that the desire that God had placed upon my heart to lead a church, to be in the pulpit, to be able to proclaim good news to others. That was my call. And the joy that it brought me when I was able to serve in those roles, even as a college student, getting to try on ministry, as I like to say, and I would, as a guest preacher or leading a devotional at the Wesley Foundation or leading a Bible study or serving with the youth where I was an intern at the same time, that the joy that it brought me was an affirmation that desire was from God. And then I had people who were also affirming that they had heard God speak through me, or they had sensed that God was calling me to something and felt, you know, wanted to affirm that in me. So that was what I needed. I had this great desire on my heart. But then when I was willing to say, oh, is this, everyone doesn't have this desire. Is this desire is from God? This desire is my call. But then to have pastors and, you know, other lay folks at the time affirm it in me was the encouragement that I needed. And so my fourth year of college, I was already on a 5-year track. My fourth year of college, I changed my major from chemistry and biology, or, you know, from chemistry biology for that pre-pharmacy plan. I changed my major to communication, so that, because I wanted to like be done with college and I just wanted to get to seminary. And I went, and kind of looked at the classes that I had had and what were the classes that I enjoyed the most. And Henderson was a liberal arts school. And so I'd had a communication class and thought, I enjoyed that. And I'll need to be an effective communicator to be a pastor. So I, 3 days into the fall semester of my fourth year, I went and visited with the chair of the communication department and changed my major. And I'd already had enough hours to have a minor in chemistry. And so the communication chair, he said, well, you're going to need a minor. I said, no, I already have one, chemistry. And he said, well, what are you going to do with that? And I was like, well, absolutely nothing. I'm going to be a pastor. And he asked me, why did I want to be a pastor? I don't know that he was a man. It was, you know, if he went to church or not, but he asked me, why did I want to be a pastor? And I explained my call to him and how excited I got with the thought of preaching and teaching and leading God's people. And he just said, well, that sounds like good work if you can find it. And I was like, I think I can. Yeah. So then I started exploring seminaries, and I had said, I'm not going to go to Duke Divinity School. I'd known a lot of pastors who had gone to Duke, and they love to talk about it a lot. And I thought, that's not for me. But one of them was one of my mentors. And so I was like, fine, I'll go visit. And when I did, I had this sense of peace on campus that was the place that I should go. So I ended up at Duke and was there from 2006 to 2009. And while I was there, I met my husband, who is also he's a pastor too. We were in the same preaching class, or we were in the same class together, but we started dating when we were in a preaching class together. So not only am I a clergywoman, but I'm married to another clergy person.
Yeah. Which brings its own challenges to ministry for sure.
It does. But a lot of unique joys. I'm glad that I'm married to another pastor, because I'm the kind of personality that needs to be around people who understand what I'm going through, that understand it not from just an intellectual thing, mm-hmm. But understand it because they have been there and they know the nuances of the work. So I actually really value being married to a clergy person, because when I was in the local church and I would have a joy or a challenge, I could talk to my spouse about it and know that he completely understood. And that means a lot to me to at home be understood in the good and the challenging parts.
Yeah, that sounds like a great blessing.
Yeah.
So on your journey to ministry, it sounds like you had a lot of social support, but were there other supports in your journey? And then also, were there any deterrents?
So I did have a lot of social support. And it's interesting that you've asked this question, because I remember when I got to seminary, my roommate was a woman, you know, my same age, and ministry was our first career. So we were coming straight out of undergrad into seminary. And she and I were talking about how we ended up at seminary. How did we end up at Duke? And both of us recognized that it felt like doors had just been opened for us, and that we were lifted up by other clergy and lay folks to get to where, you know, to get there. We had, like, when I first applied to Duke, you know, I knew that it was the school that I really wanted to go to, that I felt like that was the place for me. I don't want to say like God called me to Duke. That feels very dramatic. I think that God could have worked through the other seminaries, or the other seminary that I'd applied to and been accepted to. But when I applied to Duke, it was where I really wanted to go. And I got waitlisted, and that really, that stung, that hurt. I was really upset about it because I felt like, God, why do I want to go there? And why did I feel so good there? And why did I feel like it was the place for me? And then, have that, you know, not be accepted. So I accepted, I got accepted to another seminary, and I accepted it and was like making plans to attend there, all while I was kind of like, fingers crossed, like waiting to hear from Duke. And the day that I finished my final exam at Henderson, I opened my phone and I had a voicemail from the director of admissions at Duke that I had been accepted, that I'd been moved off of the wait list. And after I got to seminary, I worked in her office. I was a student worker in the admissions office. And she shared with me that during that time, like, after I'd been waitlisted, in between the getting waitlisted and getting accepted, which was about like 2 months from like spring break to the end of the school year. So a month and a half, 2 months. She said that she received several letters from people in Arkansas, including my bishop, pastors, and lay people in one of the churches where I'd been an intern. There had been a campaign amongst some Arkansans sending letters to Duke Divinity School saying why they needed to accept me, like why I needed to receive my theological education there. And she said it warmed her heart, but it was always something that I carried with me, that further affirmation that there were people who saw in me my call to ministry. But then also there's another side that it also meant there was a group of people at home who wanted me to come and serve in their conference, that there was a group of people who were ready to see me as one of the leaders. And that kind of holds hands with another support system that I had. And that actually is the Methodist Foundation for Arkansas. Here at the foundation, we have a seminary scholarship, and it's the largest seminary scholarship of any other Methodist foundation, that we pay full tuition at any United Methodist seminary. And so when I was graduating and going to divinity school, I applied for this scholarship and received it. So I was just waiting on, like, I was waiting to hear from Duke. Cause like, Duke, I can pay if you'll just let me in. I've got this scholarship. I don't need a scholarship from you. I've already got it. I just need acceptance, or to be admitted. The foundation gave me the scholarship, and then the president of the foundation at the time was a man named Jim Argue. And Jim had told me whenever I was home, like whenever I was in Arkansas, to come stop by the foundation and visit. And I took him up on it, and I realized that our visits were so good, and the foundation was so proud of me and the other folks that we had at seminary at that time, that they really wanted to hear from us and support us. So every time I came home, I think the foundation was actually not just the conference, but really the foundation were the leaders that I was connected to. So I knew that this organization and these people also were excited to see me come be a minister in Arkansas. So I had like the support of my campus ministers and the churches where I'd served as an intern. And then I had the support of the foundation that were opening up all these doors for me, literally like writing the letter campaign to get me accepted, but also sending the checks to pay for me to be there. And the ones who were, you know, calling in and checking on me, and that when I was home, making sure that I stopped by and had some time to visit with them.
That's a really cool story.
I had a good support. I did not, I didn't really have a lot of, I didn't have any deterrents in that whole process. Like, it just seemed, the only deterrent was like not getting an immediate acceptance to the school where I wanted to go. I didn't start encountering deterrents in ministry until I was actually in ministry. Mm. So I didn't feel that when, actually when I went to seminary, I remember thinking like, I'm just a clergy person. I'm not, there's nothing unique about me. Like, I'm a clergy person, just like a male is a clergy person. And I didn't think that I didn't think I needed to be like this, a feminist, I guess you could say. I didn't think that, that mattered. And it wasn't until the practice of ministry that I started to realize, actually, no, there are still some who are not supportive of women in ministry, not only, you know, obviously outside of the United Methodist Church, but even some within the United Methodist Church. And until serving in ministry, I didn't realize, no, it is something to celebrate that I'm a woman in this role. And I am different from, you know, a male clergy person. That there are things about being a woman that I can embrace and that can be celebrated that I bring to this work. And that actually this is a, you know, this, I don't have to try to make it sound like it doesn't matter that I'm a woman. No, it's really cool that I'm a woman doing this. So there was a lot of kind of unpacking in seminary, or really getting into the practice of ministry, why I had that attitude that it didn't matter that I'm a woman. And then kind of growing into the understanding that no, God called me uniquely as a woman, not just as a person, and being willing to see things, I guess, through a new lens or through a new frame of understanding.
If you're willing, would you share some of those like unique things that you bring to ministry as a woman and just as the person that you are?
Yeah. One of the most, I'll say, one of the most powerful preaching moments for me is, let me start off by saying this. I am not one of these people who's going to say, like, so I'm a mom, and mm-hmm. being, stepping into the pulpit after having my first child, and then telling stories of women, from the Bible, telling their stories after having given birth myself. And I've had some profound or some really powerful preaching, like personal preaching moments in that. But I'm not one of these people who's going to say, oh, once I became a mom, I learned how to love. Like, no, that's not, that's not making a, being a mom doesn't make me any better or even set apart from other, you know, other clergy women. But there was this kind of a tenderness that opened in me and a willingness to be more vulnerable after I had children. And that's very, I think, intimately connected to the fact that our first daughter was, she was born really early. She was born 3 months early. And so she stayed in the hospital for 110 days. And during that time, I was really upset with God. And I had a lot of fear and a lot of grief and sadness in it. And during that time, you know, it was an anxious and very dark season. And I remember that while I couldn't pray, there were times where I couldn't pray, but I knew there were people who were praying on my behalf. And it was a very a powerful moment to realize that the church was taking care of me in that season as the one who felt like I had been called and to help take care of the church, to be taken care of during that time. So when I stepped into the pulpit after having experienced that, being cared for by the church, when I always thought I was supposed to care for them, stepping back into the pulpit, I found a more vulnerable voice. So my preaching started to change a little bit. And later in ministry, after having our, no, I guess I hadn't had our second daughter yet, but I, people remarked, I guess, so I was still at Conway as the associate pastor after Eleanor, our first daughter, was born. And when I was leaving, people in the congregation noticed it. Your preaching changed after you came back. So it was noticed in the congregation that there was something different. And I equate it to, I was willing to be more vulnerable, in my preaching. And, another really profound experience of like being a woman, being a mom and preaching, I preached a sermon from Mary's perspective. I did not do it in the first person, but I told Mary's story, and the whole sermon was simply telling her story. And I was moved to tears in telling her story, recognizing that how the grief and the anxiety that Mary must have felt when she was super pregnant and then had to go walk for several days, or ride a donkey for several days to go take a census that some world leader, or some leader had told her that she had to do with her new husband's family, and that she had been preparing to give birth at home, and knowing the birth practices at the time, that there would have been a midwife and then she would have been surrounded by the women of her family. Mm-hmm. And the whole time that she's preparing for delivering her baby, she has the expectation that the midwife is going to be with me and the women in my family are going to be with me during this very scary time. And then she had to travel far from home and then give birth in a, not in her home, not in the comfort of any familiar place. And there were no familiar people. That she didn't have the women of her family. She didn't have the midwife who was close by. She was doing this in a manger, like in a barn. And when I was telling the story of how scared Mary must have been, I was overcome with emotion that I don't know that I could have connected as deeply with if I hadn't had a traumatic birth experience myself. The expectations that I had for what it was going to be like bringing life into the world were like drastically different from how it actually happened. And I had a 90-year-old retired male minister come up to me after that service and said, I don't think anybody else could have told us that story in the same way. And it was very affirming that for him to have heard a female voice who got emotional over Mary's birth story, for a 90-year-old man to come up and affirm, it was powerful to hear your voice, you share her story for us. And I don't know that a man could have told that story. And then would a man have told Mary's birth story? I've also discovered I have a couple of sermon series that really center on women and their stories. And when I've done those sermon series, I've done them at a couple different churches. And when I've done them, the amount of people who come up and say, wow, I've never heard her story before, or I've never heard 2 weeks in a row that we hear, that we're hearing a story about a woman 2 weeks in a row, that those weren't not only hearing like a female's voice tell these stories, but then having a pastor who wants to tell so many stories of women from the Bible. So those have been some really, I keep saying profound, but I don't mean it like in a really like braggadocious way. But those are impactful moments like in my preaching that I felt and that I could see that were impactful for others as well.
Yeah, it's an inspiring story to me. You've talked just now about women in the Bible And so how have you found that the Bible and these stories of women, or just in general, supports your call to ministry?
One of my favorite recognitions of women in ministry is Miriam, Moses' sister Miriam. My favorite Old Testament book is my favorite Old Testament story is the Exodus. And I love, because I love how women are featured so prominently in the story of Moses. Like, Moses is the one who gets lifted up, but Moses would not be Moses if there wasn't a series of women who did radical things and broke the rules in order to save his life, from his mom who refused to kill her son. You know, he was born during a time that the Israel women weren't supposed to have babies. Actually it begins with the midwives, Shifra and Pua, who deliver a male baby and don't kill him. His mom, who refused to kill him, and she, in the most like heartbreaking and greatest act of hope, she puts him in a basket and puts him in the water. And then from Pharaoh's daughter, who pulls him out of the water, that it's all these women who have literally saved his life by they were willing to break the rules. And later in the Exodus, his sister Miriam, she is referred to as a prophet. And it's the first time that in scripture that anyone is referred to as a prophet. It's the first time a woman is referred to as a prophet. The first time that word is used as a mouthpiece for God, it's for a woman. I don't know why we don't like share that more. People get confused because they think that Aaron is the first prophet, but the word that's used, this mouthpiece, Aaron is a prophet for Moses. So he says what Moses, he's a mouthpiece for Moses. Since you remember Moses said like, I'm short of tongue or whatever the phrase is. He's like, I have a stutter. I have a speech impediment. I can't talk. And he's like, great. Well, Aaron will speak for you. But Miriam is the first one that's going to be a mouthpiece for God. Like, why don't we talk about that more, that the first mouthpiece for God is a woman? And so that was a powerful discovery for me. And then to find out that Eve is called the helpmate, and often use this, that means that she is has this submissive role. But that understanding that she was submissive was not in my study. I learned that idea was a more modern idea that was brought to the text than what the original, the original understanding, because it's this studying these Hebrew words, helpmate, sounds like a submissive term, but it's only used one other place in the Bible, and it's used to describe God. That God is our helpmate. So again, I learned these stories and those word studies in the practice of ministry. Actually, when I was an associate pastor leading a Bible study for women, I realized that Miriam is the first prophet. And then I realized that Eve, being referred to as the helpmate, is not this submissive term, but why can it be highlighted if the term used to describe the woman is the same one that is used to describe God in the Psalms? Like, that feels like something pretty powerful for women. So those two examples get me really excited to think about what is the role and the place of women in the church and in ministry. Well, we're prophets, like we're helpmates, just like God is. And obviously it's like so many people, I don't think you can ignore the fact that I don't think it's any small point that the first people to proclaim the resurrection were the women. That I remember in seminary when we studied in our class on the New Testament, and we got to the resurrection and the resurrection appearance and those post-resurrection proclamation, or the what the women did after it's, you know, every time that the ones who witnessed the resurrection were always the women. And my professor pointed out, or maybe it was like the preceptor for the class pointed out, that if the biblical writers wanted this story to sound truer or more plausible, wouldn't they have wanted to put a male voice to it? That like, that if a male voice was going to give it more credibility because of the patriarchy at the time, wouldn't saying that it was the men who saw Jesus and then proclaimed it, wouldn't that make the story sound more believable? But by having it remain, it's the women who are proclaiming this, it almost authenticates the story. That this is the way it really happened, because this is not the most believable way that it would have happened. It's not lost on me, you know, just like so many, that the first ones to, the first Easter sermon was delivered by a woman. Or he is, you know, to, for the women to proclaim that the tomb is empty and they've seen Jesus in the garden. But also there's the story of the woman who encounters Jesus at the well, and she's there in the middle of the day. I get really tired of people preaching her story, saying that she's a woman of ill repute because she's had five husbands. That's not why. In that time, a woman couldn't ask for a divorce. The only person who could get a divorce was a man. And the two primary reasons that a man would get a divorce is he wanted to leave, or his wife was barren. So for a woman who'd been married five times, that's through no fault of her own. Mm-hmm. She couldn't ask for a divorce. And she also couldn't just sleep around, because if she had slept around and had sex outside of her marriage, she would be stoned. So for a woman to have been married five times wasn't because she was out, you know, just living a life of ill repute, but rather she left five times. She may have been barren. So she's not coming to the well because it's really embarrassing for a woman to be barren, to have been left that many times. So she's going to the well in the middle of the day when there's no one else there. She sees Jesus, and he offers her water, you know, from the eternal spring, from a well that will never dry up. And he says, you know, you've not been married once, you've been married five times, and the man you're with isn't your husband. That could be because she was in a Levirate marriage. So if her husband died, she would then become the wife of his father or his brother. And the man you're with is not your husband. Well, she can't just be shacking up with a man. She'd be stoned. So her story is very heartbreaking. And Jesus sees her and speaks to her. And then she leaves from that place and says, I've met the man who told me everything about myself. Like, that's a sermon. I've encountered the one who offered me living water. So, you know, she's one of the first voices also proclaiming, you know, I've met the one who offered me living water. That's what we say in sermons. You know, we're telling about the one, Jesus Christ, whom we've encountered, who knows us and sees us and offers us life eternal. So that's, I get really excited thinking about the women in scripture, because there's lots of incredible stories that their stories are often not lifted up, or they're not lifted up, I think, with the excitement, the excitement and energy and the exegesis that they deserve.
Yeah, and you tell them so beautifully, and I didn't know half of that. I feel inspired and empowered right now.
Good, good. Well, I can recommend some books to you that are that will change your that were helpful for me when I wanted to start preaching women's stories more and hopefully more accurate. One of my funnest favorite parts or stories from ministry, I led a Bible study, and it was at Conway. It was with women, and we were reading this story about women from the old, it was a book, Women from the Old Testament. Each chapter was a different woman of the Old Testament. And I hated the book so much because the author, a woman, made every woman out to be like, she was so sinful and God still used her, like, you know, Miriam. One of the reasons that I know a lot about some of these women is because when this woman spoke so negatively about women, I thought this is not, there's another way to read this and another way to understand it. And so I did deeper research. And so I hated that study. And I remember going back to the women and they all came to class angry because they didn't understand why these women were portrayed so negatively. And then I said, we can quit. And they said, no, because we love this conversation. Like, this conversation is so good. Disagreeing with the author stirred in us so much energy and excitement to be in conversation with one another and, you know, in conversation with the author as we're debating in the class. But then when the study was over, I said, this has been so great. Like, this conversation has been so wonderful for us. Give me your books. We're going to throw them away. These aren't going to the church library. They're not going to go in the resort, like the class resource room where other groups can do this study. Like, this study ends with us. We're not doing any more by this author. And we agreed, like, it led to really engaging conversation, but we didn't trust it to stay in circulation in our church. So we literally, like, I took the books up and I threw them away.
Yeah, you have to be careful with how you present it and everything and making sure that people know that sometimes you got to take it more than face value.
I forget Abraham was married to Sarah, and then after Sarah died, Abraham marries, I cannot think of, Zipporah, right? Isn't that correct?
Then to Zipporah.
And one of the chapters was on Zipporah, and the whole, like, her byline, it was like, Zipporah, and it was like, bad second wife. Like,
wow.
Terrible, not a model for being a second wife. And I was like, what in the world? Like, why is she in trouble already? And so it forced me to do some, it made me so uncomfortable. So I did some deeper research and then and one of the cool things was the Midrash, which is, like where the rabbis, as they're studying the scrolls, they would make little notes in the margins, just some commentary in the margins. And in the Midrash, so ancient tradition believed that Zipporah was actually Haggai, Abraham's, the wife, Ishmael's mother. Mm-hmm. And then when Sarah died, Abraham married Haggai. And I thought, that's a beautiful, I don't know if this is true, but it was what the ancient tradition held. And that was kind of a beautiful redemption of that story. And so that was something, you know, we were able to say, it could be Haggai. I think it could just as much be her as this author saying that Zipporah was a terrible second wife. So that was a fun experience with a terrible study that led to some really great discoveries. And I can remember the author's name, but I can't even remember the book.
So it sounds like you've had some congregation members who are pretty supportive of women in ministry. But have you faced any troubles simply for being a woman in the pulpit in your ministry?
Yeah, there've only been a couple of times where I'll say yes. The answer is definitely yes. there've only been a couple of times where it's been really overt and like named. And most of the time that it's named has been with folks that I was in ministry with, but they weren't members of the church. So two of the most hurtful experiences happened when I was an associate at Conway and I was doing pastoral care for a church member, like for a beloved church member. And one time a church member had emergency surgery late at night and I went to the hospital and I sat with the family, but the family's like extended family, their pastor came as well, a man. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I say it was late at night. It was like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And I just came, I rushed from home. I think I was in jeans, like in more comfortable clothes. Their pastor was a man who showed up at 9 or 10 o'clock at night in a suit at the hospital.
Oh, wow.
So the woman who had emergency surgery is a member of my congregation. And I had been there with the family. But after the surgery was over and, you know, she had made it through the surgery. So it was time, like people were, you know, everybody breathed a sigh of relief. And we definitely wanted to pray and thank God for this. Before I could say anything, the male pastor was like, and now we're going to pray. And so he led the prayer. And I was like, no. I'm the pastor here. This is my, she's a member of my flock. Mm-hmm. And it made me so mad that he had met me. He knew I was one of her pastors and that her husband's pastor mm-hmm. and her children's pastor. And he was her sister's pastor, but he was like, I'm going to pray. Mm-hmm. So that really bugged me. Because then once he finishes praying, I can't say like, and now, hey guys, I'm going to pray too.
Yeah.
Pastor Lynn's going to pray. So like, I just had to let him pray. And then another time I was visiting a church member who was having surgery. And I was sitting with his brother and sister-in-law out in the waiting room. And so I had prayed with the man in pre-op, and then I was going and sitting in the waiting room to sit with his family while we, you know, he went through the pray while he had surgery. And like during that time, the brother said, so how do you do what you do? I was like, well, what do you mean? He was like, well, how are you a minister when the Bible's pretty clearly against it? Like when what the Bible has to say about a woman in ministry. And I'm wondering, like, well, this is how I do it. I show mm-hmm. up and like, and I pray and I sit with family. At that point, I didn't really know how to respond. I think that was the first time someone had ever like just clearly asked me, like, why do you think you're a minister because you're a woman? And I don't know what I said. I'm sure it wasn't very eloquent. But all that to say that those most overt times when people have challenged my ministry because I'm a woman, they've been people who are outside of the church. Mm-hmm. But inside the church, it's much more subtle. Mm-hmm. And I would talk like with my other, I call them my clergy girlfriends. We kind of say it's like the, it's death by paper cuts, that there mm-hmm. are really, that there are really small things that happen that if you try to say like this thing that this person is doing that like very tiny stuff, like they're willing to call a male pastor, you know, Pastor Brent, but mm-hmm. then calling me Lynn. Like if I were to say like, no, call me pastor, I'm pastor too. Like, well, geez, like,
yeah,
it's so tiny. And so many of the really small things, you can't really call out one of them or you sound too emotional, you know, you sound too sensitive. But when you feel all of these tiny little things, I mean, it's death by paper cuts. Just these little bitty, little times. And it's stuff like when I would, supervise staff that, mm-hmm. They might speak to me in a way that's, you know, unprofessional or inappropriate in a way that they never would have spoken to like a male supervisor. Earlier I mentioned, you know, it's great to be married to a clergy person because he understands. It also, you know, like my husband and I, Nathan would come home and we could compare in the way that people treated him versus the way people would treat me. Like, mm-hmm. they're not saying these things about him. And also it's, Nathan and I, in our first few years of ministry, he got a raise like every year, like every church served, they gave him a raise. In my first 10 years of ministry, the only raises I got were like when I went to a different church. Mm-hmm. I received one raise at one church. And it might have only, I can't, it might have been I got $1,000 raise and I got it for 1 year and they had to cut it. They cut those raises. So they had to take everybody's raises back. So when I was a senior pastor, I got raises for my staff every year. Like we were growing, we were raising the budget, and I got them. I gave the staff an increase, and every year the SPRC would say, or I would say, you know, don't give me a raise, I don't need it, and they would say, okay. And I was like, I don't want a raise, but I do want you to like just argue with me, like
yeah.
But it was also really interesting that, you know, churches of similar financial situations. They gave my husband a raise every year. You know, each church gave him a raise, but mine didn't. And I said, is that like, why? That's interesting. I don't know. You know, I don't know if I'm comparing apples to apples, but that's interesting. And I should say my last church, they did at the end of my time there. There were people who recognized you've been here 5 years and you've kept yourself out of every conversation of a salary increase. And so my last year that I was there, they did give me a raise and I let them do it, which was like super uncomfortable. So I think that's also a kind of a more stereotypical feminine leadership is that we don't advocate for ourselves. We don't ask for raises and we get like really uncomfortable when the church would try to give us one. So, you know, at the end of that time, they said they were going to give me a raise. And then when it actually came time for them to do it, like I talked them into cutting it in half. So I didn't even take like, that's the, for me, the challenges in ministry were just these small things. And sometimes it would be because I could compare, I have a husband at home, a man in ministry, and seeing the different ways that we were treated.
So like you were saying with asking for raises and stuff, there definitely is a different way in how you have to present yourself and how you go about leading the church. What would you say some of the most distinct ways you have to think about how you present yourself in ministry are?
Couple of things. One, there are areas where women are it's just kind of painting with broad strokes that they think you're not going to be confident in. And so you just have to go in and fake it till you make it or like get informed, know how to do it. It's like, I knew that like sometimes they think that women aren't good or, you know, females aren't good with money or we can't understand a budget. So I felt like when I went in as the senior pastor, I could never let them know if I was confused about anything in the budget. So like I went in and I did some continuing ed before becoming a senior pastor to really learn about being the one who's supposed to oversee this budget and keep the church, you know, financially above board and in the black. I had to go in and just exude confidence in the areas of the area of stewardship. That was one place for me that. And then I was also, I just finished a book. I just finished a book called Likeable Badass.
Ooh.
And it's about being, being a, being a successful woman, and it really, it could be for anybody, but oftentimes women, you can either be likable or you can be successful and assertive, that you, these two things can't exist together, but we can all think of women who are like likable badasses that are really good at what they do, but they're also, you like them.
Yeah.
They're really great. And so I think for women, we have to go in and it is even harder for us to be likable badasses. It is for some of our male colleagues. And so the author Allison Fergaley talks about to be the likable badass is to be both assertive and warm. So being assertive, being a leader, but also finding ways to still convey warmth and authenticity so that you can be that likable leader, because things that it seems like for women, things that a man could say that no one would be upset by, if we were to say it, like, well, who does she think she is? Or, you know, there's a word that we use for women that are assertive or, you know, confident in their leadership. And so for us, that balancing of conveying, finding how we're going to convey the warmth. And I can't remember the original question now, but I would say lean into your authentic self, and don't try to just become masculine in your leadership, but lead in the way that is most true to your personality and yourself. I think that is also what's going to make us, you know, warm and likable. Not just trying to be masculine. Did I answer the question? I feel like I jumped
around. Yeah, you did. That was also great advice for someone like me who is going into ministry and wondering, how do I make that balance? So yeah, that was really
useful. I recommend that book. It's really good. There's a big middle section that I'm like, oh, this doesn't really speak to ministry, but the first third and the last third of the book are really excellent.
Yeah. So to finish up, I have one final question for you. And I want to know where you're finding the most joy in your ministry and where you feel God is calling you, in the next couple of years or your rest of your life in ministry.
Yeah. So I'm in interesting work now that I'm at the Methodist Foundation for Arkansas. I'm full-time here at the Methodist Foundation for Arkansas. I also have a part-time position where I serve as the executive director of the National Association of United Methodist Foundations. And I'm really finding joy in the ministry that is made possible because of our foundations. That, you know, foundations were more than just money managers. So we manage money for Methodist churches and institutions, but because we manage that money, it means that we have the incomes, the resources to fund gap ministries in churches and to provide help, resources, and services to local churches. So I get really excited to think about, you know, very unique to my positions, the impact that Methodist foundations are having on the United Methodist Church across our connection. So not only Arkansas, which is obviously like my favorite foundation and where my heart is, but then from my other seat, my other position, I get to see that there are other, you know, 46 other foundations that are having an impact in their ministries as well. So that's bringing me joy. And I still really love that I get into the pulpit a lot. So I, there are times that I really miss having my own congregation that I get to, you know, step into their pulpit, every Sunday, because when you're with the same congregation week in and week out, you learn their stories. And I think that's also like why my preaching changed after Eleanor was born, was because Eleanor was born when I'd been at the church 3 years. Like I had spent 3 years with those folks. So when I stepped into the pulpit and looked down to the congregation, I knew all their names. Like, I knew who they were. I knew their stories. I knew their families. So when I preached, and when I could preach about a particular topic, I could know this is something they're struggling with. So I miss that I don't know the people when I step into a pulpit, I don't know their stories, but they're still a part of me, you know, just like that junior high kid who's like, I want to get up there and I want to preach. I enjoy doing it. I like how it, I mean, I enjoy how it feels in the pulpit. And it's just a powerful feeling to think that, you know, we get to be a mouthpiece for God. And we get to proclaim joy or comfort or hope or challenge. So I'm grateful. I'm finding joy that I still get invited to preach at churches. And I get to live out, you know, that very first desire that revealed my call into ministry, you know, back when I was in junior high. Like, I want to be in that pulpit, and I still get the opportunity, even though it's not every Sunday and it's not in the same place. Mm-hmm. I get to step into a pulpit and preach, and that's fun work that's worth doing, and it's really fun.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, thank you for sharing your story with me and everybody who will listen to this podcast. You've shared beautiful insights that I know have inspired me to continue on this journey, and so I thank you for that. And just for this time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Her Words. If you would like to hear more stories of women in ministry in the United Methodist Church, check out our other episodes.